Instead, he kept following the breaking news developments with absent-minded interest. Blomqvist's visit had turned his peace and quiet upside down. Björk never had any inkling that Salander's orgy of murder might involve him personally, that one of her victims had been a media swine who was about to expose him to the whole of Sweden. He had even less of an idea that the name Zala would crop up in the story like a hand grenade with its pin pulled, and least of all that the name would be known to a journalist like Blomqvist. It defied all common sense. The day after Blomqvist's visit, Björk telephoned his former boss, who was 78 years old and living in Laholm. He had to try to worm out the context without letting on that he was calling for any reason other than pure curiosity and professional concern. It was a relatively short conversation.
"This is Björk. I assume you've read the papers?"
"I have. She's popped up again."
"And she doesn't seem to have changed much?"
"It's no longer our concern."
"You don't think that—"
"No, I don't. All that is dead and buried. There's no connection."
"But Bjurman, of all people, I presume it wasn't by chance that he became her guardian?"
There were several seconds of silence on the line.
"No, it was no accident. It seemed like a good idea 3 years ago. Who could have predicted this?"
"How much did Bjurman know?"
His former boss chuckled.
"You know quite well what Bjurman was like. Not the most talented actor."
"I mean, did he know about the connection? Could there be something among his papers or personal effects that would lead anyone to—"
"No, of course not. I understand what you're getting at, but don't worry. Salander has always been the loose cannon in this story. We arranged it so that Bjurman got the assignment, but that was only so we'd have someone we could check up on. Better that than an unknown quantity. If she had started blabbing, he would have come to us. Now this will all work out for the best."
"What do you mean?"
"Well, after this, Salander is going to be sitting in a psychiatric ward for a long, long time."
"That makes sense."
"Don't worry. Go and enjoy your sick leave in peace and quiet."
But that was exactly what Björk was unable to do. Blomqvist had seen to that. He sat at the kitchen table and looked out over Jungfrufjorden as he tried to sum up his own situation. He was being threatened from two flanks. Blomqvist was going to hang him out to dry as a John. There was a serious risk that he would end his police career by being convicted of breaking the sex trade law. But even more serious was the fact that Blomqvist was trying to track down Zalachenko. Somehow he was mixed up in the story too, and Zala would lead him back to Björk's front door. His former boss had apparently been assured that there was nothing among Bjurman's personal effects that could provide a further lead. But there was. The report from 1991. And Bjurman had gotten it from Björk. He tried to visualize the meeting with Bjurman more than 3 months earlier. They had met in Gamlestan. Bjurman had called him one afternoon at work and suggested they have a beer. They talked about the shooting club and everything under the sun, but Bjurman had sought him out for a particular reason. He needed a favor. He had asked about Zalachenko. Björk got up and stood by the kitchen window. He had been a little tipsy at the meeting. In fact, he was quite drunk. What had Bjurman asked him?
"Speaking of which, I'm in the middle of doing something for an old acquaintance who's popped up."
"Oh, yeah? Who's that?"
"Alexander Zalachenko. Do you remember him?"
"Are you kidding?
He's not an easy man to forget."
"Whatever happened to him?"
Technically, it was none of Bjurman's business. In fact, there was good reason to put Bjurman under the microscope just for having asked. But he was Salander's guardian. He said he needed the old report.
"And I gave it to him."
Björk had made a serious mistake. He had assumed that Bjurman had already been informed. Anything else would have seemed unthinkable. And Bjurman had presented the matter as though he was only trying to take a short cut through the plodding bureaucratic procedure in which everything was stamped confidential and hush-hush and could drag on for months. In particular, anything that had to do with Zalachenko.
"I gave him the report. It was still stamped confidential.
But it was for a good and understandable reason, and Bjorman was not someone who would spill the beans. He was stupid, but he had never been a gossip. What could it hurt? It was so many years ago.
Bjorman had made a fool of him. The more Björk thought about it, the more convinced he was that Bjorman had chosen his words deliberately, very cautiously. But what the fuck was Bjorman after? And why would Salander have murdered him?
Blomqvist went to the apartment in Lundegarten 4 more times on Saturday in the hope of finding Miriam Wu, but she was never there. He spent a good part of the day at the café bar on Hornsgarten, with his iBook, re-reading the emails that Svensson had received at his Millennium address and the contents of the folder named Zala. In the weeks before he was murdered, Svensson had spent more and more time researching Zala. Blomqvist wished he could phone Svensson and ask him why the document about Irina P. was in the Zala folder. The only reasonable conclusion was that Svensson had suspected Zala of murdering her. At 5 p.m., Boblansky called and gave him Marion Wu's phone number. He didn't know what had made the detective change his mind, but now that he had the number, he tried it about once every half hour. Not until 11 p.m. did she answer. It was a short conversation.
"Hello, Miriam. My name is Mikhail Blomqvist."
"And who the hell are you?"
"I'm a journalist, and I work at a magazine called Millennium."
Miriam Wu expressed her feelings in a pithy way.
"Ah, yes, that Blomqvist. Go to hell, journalist creep."
She broke off the connection before Blomqvist had a chance to explain what he wanted. He directed some bad thoughts at Tony Scala and tried to call back. She did not answer. In the end, he sent a text message.
"Please call me. It's important."
She never called. Late that night, Blomqvist shut down his computer, undressed, and crawled into bed. He wished he had Berger to keep him company.
Part 4. Terminator Mode. March 24th to April 8th. The root of an equation is a number which, substituted into the equation instead of an unknown, converts the equation into an identity. The root is said to satisfy the equation. Solving an equation implies finding all of its roots. An equation that is always satisfied, no matter the choice of values for its unknowns, is called an identity. A plus B squared equals A squared plus 2AB plus B squared. Chapter 21. Maundy Thursday, March 24th, to Monday, April 4th. Salander spent the first week of the police hunt far from the drama. She remained in peace and quiet in her apartment on Fiskargatan. Her mobile was turned off and the SIM card taken out. She did not intend to use that phone again. Her eyes grew wide with astonishment as she followed the stories in the online editions of the newspapers and on the TV news programs. She was irritated by the passport photograph that appeared everywhere. She looked stupid. Despite her years of striving for anonymity, she had been transformed overnight into one of the most notorious and talked-about individuals in Sweden. She began to realize that a nationwide alert for a short girl suspected of 3 murders was one of the year's biggest news stories. She followed the commentary and speculation in the media with amazement, fascinated that confidential documents about her medical history seemed to be accessible to any newsroom that wanted to publish them. One headline in particular awakened buried memories. "Arrested for assault in Gamlastan." A court reporter at TT Wire Service had scooped his competitors by digging up a medical report that had been written when Salander was arrested for kicking a passenger in the face at Gamlastan Tunnelbana station. She had been at Odenplan and was on her way back to her foster home in Hagerston. At Rodmansgarten, an apparently sober stranger had got on the train and immediately focused his attention on her. Later she discovered that he was Carl Evert Norgren, an unemployed former athlete from Gävle. Despite the fact that the carriage was half empty, he sat down next to her and began to bother her. He put his hand on her knee and tried to start a conversation along the lines of, "I'll give you 200 if you come home with me." When she ignored him, he got pushy and called her a sour old cunt. The fact that she refused to talk to him and had changed seats at T. Centralen had no effect. As they were approaching Gamlestan, he put his arms around her from behind and pushed them up inside her sweater, whispering in her ear that she was a whore. She replied with an elbow to his eye, and then grabbed one of the upright poles, lifted herself up, and kicked him with both heels across the bridge of his nose, which prompted heavy bleeding. She was dressed as a punk and had blue-dyed hair, so she had little chance to melt into the crowd when the train stopped at the platform. A friend of Law and Order had grappled with her and held her down on the ground until the police arrived. She cursed her gender. Nobody would have dared attack her if she had been a man. She hardly made any attempt to explain why she had kicked Carl Evert Norgren in the face. She didn't think it was worth trying to explain anything to uniformed authorities. She refused on principle to respond when psychiatrists tried to determine her mental state. As luck would have it, several other passengers had observed the whole course of events, including a persistent woman from Hønesand, who happened to be a member of Parliament for the Centre Party. The woman testified that Norgren had assaulted Salander before the violence broke out. When it later turned out that Norgren had been convicted for sexual offences twice before, the prosecutor decided to drop the case. But that did not mean that the social welfare report on Salander was set aside. Not long afterwards, the district court declared her incompetent, and she ended up under the guardianship of Holger Palmgren, and later Niels Bjørman. Now all of these intimate and confidential details were on the net for public consumption. Her personal record was supplemented with colourful descriptions of how she had come into conflict with people around her since elementary school, and how she spent her early teens in a children's psychiatric clinic. The diagnoses of Salander in the press varied depending on which edition and which newspaper was doing the reporting. Sometimes she was described as psychotic, and sometimes as schizophrenic or paranoid. All the papers subscribed to the view that she was mentally handicapped. After all, she hadn't been able to finish school. The public should have no doubt that she was unbalanced and inclined to violence. When it was discovered that Salander was friends with a lesbian Miriam Wu, a frenzy broke out in certain papers. Wu had appeared in Benita Costa's show at the Gay Pride Festival, a provocative performance in which she was photographed topless, wearing leather chaps with suspenders and high-heeled patent leather boots. She had also written articles for a gay newspaper that were widely quoted, as were the interviews she had given in connection with her appearance in various shows. The combination of mass murder and titillating S&M sex was evidently doing wonders for circulation figures. Since Wu hadn't surfaced during that first dramatic week, there was speculation that she too might have fallen victim to Salander's violence, or that she could have been an accomplice. These speculations, however, were restricted for the most part to the unsophisticated internet chat room Exile. On the other hand, several newspapers floated the theory that since Mia Johansson's thesis dealt with the sex trade, this might be Salander's motive for the murders, on the grounds that, according to the Social Welfare Agency, she was a prostitute. At the end of the week, the media discovered that Salander also had connections to a group of young women who flirted with Satanism. They called themselves Evil Fingers, and this caused an older male cultural columnist to write about the rootlessness of youth and the dangers that lurk in everything from skinhead culture to hip-hop. When all the media assertions were put together, the police appeared to be hunting for a psychotic lesbian who had joined a cult of Satanists that propagandized for S&M sex and hated society in general, and men in particular. Because Salander had been abroad for the past year, there might be international connections too. In only one case did Salander react with any great emotion to the media uproar. "We were scared of her. She threatened to kill us," say teacher and schoolmates. The person making the statement was a former teacher, now a textile artist named Birgitta Mjøs. Salander had been 11 on the occasion in question. She remembered Mjøs as an unpleasant substitute math teacher who, time after time, had tried to get her to answer a question that she'd already answered correctly, even though the answer key in the textbook said she was wrong. In fact, the textbook was wrong, and as far as Salander was concerned, that should have been obvious to everyone. But Mjøs had grown more and more obstinate, and Salander became less and less willing to discuss the matter. She sat there pouting until Mios, out of sheer frustration, grabbed her by the shoulder and shook her to get her attention. Elizabeth responded by throwing the textbook at Mios's head, which started a big hullabaloo. She spat and hissed and kicked when her classmates tried to hold on to her. The article ran as a feature in an evening paper, and allowed space for a sidebar with some quotes and a photograph of a former classmate posing in front of the entrance to her old school. This was David Gustafsson, who now called himself a financial assistant. He claimed that the students were afraid of Salander because she threatened to kill somebody once. Salander remembered Gustafsson was one of the biggest bullies in school, a powerful brute with the IQ of a stump, who seldom passed up an opportunity to dish out insults and punches in the hallway. Once he had attacked her behind the gym during lunch break, and as usual she had fought back. From a purely physical standpoint she didn't have a chance, but her attitude was that death was better than capitulation. The incident deteriorated when a large number of her schoolmates gathered in a circle to watch Gustafsson knock her to the ground over and over again. It had been amusing up to a point, but the stupid girl did not seem to understand what was good for her, and refused to back down. She didn't even cry or beg for mercy. Finally he gave Salander two serious punches that split her lip and knocked the wind out of her. Her schoolmates left her in a miserable heap behind the gym and ran away laughing. Salander had gone home and licked her wounds. 2 days later she came back, carrying a bat. In the middle of the playground she slugged Gustafsson in the ear. As he lay there in shock, she bent down, pressed the bat to his throat, and whispered in his ear that if he ever touched her again, she would kill him. When the teachers discovered what had happened, Gustafsson was taken to the school nurse, while Salander was sent to the head teacher for punishment, further comments in her record, and more social welfare reports. Salander had not thought about either Mios or Gustafsson for at least 15 years. She made a mental note to check out what they were up to these days, when she had some spare time. The result of all this press attention was that Salander had become both famous and infamous to the entire Swedish population. Her background was charted, scrutinized, and published, down to the most minute detail, from her outbursts in elementary school to her being committed to St. Stefan's Psychiatric Clinic for Children outside Uppsala, where she spent more than 2 years. She pricked up her ears when Chief of Staff Dr. Peter Teleborian was interviewed on TV. Salander had last seen him 8 years earlier, in connection with a district court hearing regarding her declaration of incompetence. His brow was deeply furrowed, and he scratched at a thin beard when he turned to the studio reporter with concern and explained that he was bound by confidentiality, and thus could not discuss an individual patient. All he could say was that Salander's was an extremely complex case, that she required expert care, and that the district court, against his recommendation, had decided to place her under guardianship in society, rather than give her the institutional care she needed. It was a scandal, Teleborian claimed. He regretted that 3 people had now paid with their lives as a result of this misjudgment, and he made sure to get in a few jabs at the cutbacks in psychiatric care that the government had forced through in recent decades. Salander noted that no newspaper revealed that the most common form of care in the secure ward of the Children's Psychiatric Hospital, for which Dr. Teleborian was responsible, was to place unruly and unmanageable patients in a room that was free of stimuli. The room contained only a bed with a restraining belt. The textbook explanation was that unruly children could not receive any stimuli that might trigger an outburst. When she grew older, she discovered that there was another term for the same thing, sensory deprivation. According to the Geneva Conventions, subjecting prisoners to sensory deprivation was classified as inhumane. It was a commonly used element in experiments with brainwashing conducted by various dictatorial regimes, and there was evidence that the political prisoners who confessed to all sorts of crimes during the Moscow trials in the 1930s had been subjected to such treatment. As Salander watched Teleborian's face on TV, her heart became a little lump of ice. She wondered whether he still used the same disgusting aftershave. He had been responsible for what was defined as her care. Salander had rapidly come to the realization that an unruly and unmanageable patient was equivalent to one who questioned Teleborian's reasoning and expertise. She had spent about half of her time at St. Stephen's strapped to the bed in the stimulus-free room. Teleborian had never touched her sexually. He had never touched her at all, other than in the most innocent situations. On one occasion he had placed a hand on her shoulder as a warning when she lay strapped down in isolation. She wondered if her teeth marks were still visible on the knuckle of his little finger. The whole thing had developed into a vicious game in which Teleborian held all the cards. Her defense had been to ignore him completely whenever he was in the room. She was 12 when she was transported by 2 police women to St. Stephen's. It was a few weeks after all the evil had occurred. She remembered every detail. First, she had thought that everything would work out somehow. She had tried to explain her version to police officers, social workers, hospital personnel, nurses, doctors, psychiatrists, and even a pastor who wanted her to pray with him. As she sat in the back seat of the police car and they passed the Wenner-Gren Center on the way north to Uppsala, she still did not know where they were heading. Nobody told her. That was when she began to sense that nothing would ever work out. She had tried to explain to Teleborian. The result of her efforts was that on the night she turned 13, she lay strapped to the bed. Teleborian was the most loathsome and disgusting sadist Salander had ever met in her life, bar none. He outclassed Bjurman by a mile. Bjurman had been unspeakably brutal, but she could handle him. Teleborian, on the other hand, was shielded behind a curtain of documents, assessments, academic honours, and psychiatric mumbo-jumbo. Not a single one of his actions could ever be reported or criticised. He had a state-endorsed mandate to tie down disobedient little girls with leather straps. And every time Salander lay shackled on her back, and he tightened the straps, and she met his gaze, she could read his excitement. She knew, and he knew that she knew. The night she turned 13, she decided never again to exchange a word with Teleborian or any other psychiatrist or shrink. That was her birthday present to herself. And she had kept her promise. She knew that it infuriated Teleborian, and perhaps contributed more than anything else to her being strapped down so tightly night after night. But that was a price she was willing to pay. She taught herself everything about self-control. She had no more outbursts, nor did she throw things on the days she was released from isolation. But she refused to talk to doctors. On the other hand, she spoke politely to the nurses, the kitchen staff, and the cleaning women. This was noted. A friendly nurse, whose name was Carolina, and whom Salander trusted up to a point, asked her one day why she acted the way she did. Salander gave her a quizzical look. "Why won't you talk to the doctors? Because they don't listen to what I say." She was aware that all such comments were entered into her record, documenting that her silence was a completely rational decision. During her last year at St. Stephen's, Salander was placed in the isolation cell less often. When it did happen, it was always because she had irritated Dr. Teleborian in some way, which she seemed to do as soon as he laid eyes on her. He tried over and over again to break through her obstinate silence and force her to acknowledge his existence. For a time he prescribed Salander a type of psychiatric drug that made it hard for her to breathe or think, which in turn brought on anxiety. From then on she refused to take her medicine, and this resulted in the decision to force-feed her 3 tablets a day. Her resistance was so strong that the staff had to hold her down, pry open her mouth, and then force her to swallow. The first time, Salander immediately stuck her fingers down her throat and vomited her lunch onto the nearest orderly. After that she was given the tablets when she was strapped down, so she learned to throw up without having to stick her fingers down her throat. Her obstinate resistance and the extra work this made for the staff led to a suspension of the medication. She had just turned 15 when she was without warning moved back to Stockholm to live once more with a foster family. The change came as a shock to her. At that time, Teleborian was not yet running St. Stephen's. Salander was sure that this was the only reason she had been released. If Teleborian had been given responsibility for the decision, she would still be strapped to the bed in the isolation cell. Now she was watching him on TV. She wondered if he fantasized about her ending up in his care again, or if she was now too old to arouse him. His reference to the district court's decision not to institutionalize her provoked the indignation of the interviewer, although apparently he had no idea what questions to ask. There was nobody to contradict Teleborian. The former chief of staff at St. Stephen's had since died. The district court judge who had presided over Salander's case, and who now had in part to accept the role as the villain in the drama, had retired and was refusing to comment to the press. Salander found one of the most astonishing articles in the online edition of a newspaper published in central Sweden. She read it three times before she turned off her computer and lit a cigarette. She sat on her IKEA pillow in the window seat and dejectedly watched the lights outside. "She's bisexual," says childhood friend. The 26-year-old woman sought in connection with three murders is described as an introverted eccentric who had great difficulties adjusting to school. Despite many attempts to include her in the group, she remained an outsider. "She obviously had problems with her sexual identity," recalls Joanna, one of her few close friends at school. "It was clear early on that she was different and that she was bisexual. We were very concerned about her." The article went on to describe some episodes that this Joanna remembered. Salander frowned. She could remember neither the episodes, nor that she'd had a close friend named Joanna. In fact, she could not recall ever knowing anyone who could be described as a close friend, or who tried to draw her into a group at school. The article did not specify when these episodes were supposed to have taken place, but she had left school when she was 12. This meant that her concerned childhood friend must have discovered Salander's bisexuality when she was 10, maybe 11. Among the flood of ridiculous articles over the past week, the one quoting Joanna hit her hardest. It was so obviously fabricated. Either the reporter had run across a mythomaniac, or he had made up the story himself. She memorized the reporter's name, and added him to the list of subjects for future research. Not even the more positive reports, ones that criticized society with headlines such as "Society Fails," or "She Never Got the Help She Needed," could dilute her standing as public enemy number one, a mass murderer who in one fit of insanity had executed three honorable citizens. Salander read these interpretations of her life with a certain fascination, and noted an obvious hole in the public knowledge. Despite apparently unlimited access to the most classified details of her life, the media had completely missed all the evil, which had happened just before her 13th birthday. The published information ranged from kindergarten to the age of 11, and was taken up again when, at the age of 15, she was released from the psychiatric clinic. Somebody within the police investigation must be providing the media with information, but for reasons unknown to Salander, the source had decided to cover up all the evil. This surprised her. If the police wanted to emphasize her penchant for vicious behavior, then that report in her file would have been the most damning by far. It was the very reason that she was sent to St. Stephen's. On Easter Sunday, Salander began to follow the police investigation more closely. From what she culled from the media, she built a picture of its participants. Prosecutor Richard Ekstrom was the leader of the preliminary investigation and usually the spokesman at press conferences. The actual investigation was headed by Criminal Inspector Jan Boblanski, a somewhat overweight man in an ill-fitting suit who flanked Ekstrom when they were speaking to the press. After a few days, she had identified Sonja Murdig as the team's only female detective and the person who had found Bjurman. She noted the names Hans Faster and Kurt Andersen, but she missed Jerka Holmberg altogether, as his name was not mentioned in any of the articles. She created a file on her computer for each person on the team and began to fill them with information. Naturally, information about how the police investigation was proceeding was kept on the computers used by the investigating detectives, and their databases were stored on the server at police headquarters. Salander knew that it would be exceptionally hard to hack into the police intranet, but it was by no means impossible. She had done it before. when working on an assignment for Armansky several years earlier, she had plotted the structure of the police intranet and assessed the possibility of hacking into the criminal register to make her own entries. She had failed miserably in her attempts to hack in from outside. The police firewalls were too sophisticated and mined with all sorts of traps that might result in unwelcome attention. The internal police network was a state-of-the-art design with its own cabling, shielded from external connections and the Internet itself. In other words, what she needed was either a police officer who had authorization to access the network, or the next best thing, to make the police intranet believe that she was an authorized person. In this respect, fortunately, the police security experts had left a gaping hole. Police stations all around the country had uplinks to the network, and several of them were small local units that were unstaffed at night and often had no burglar alarms or security patrols. The police station in Longvik, outside Vesteros, was one of these. It occupied about 1,400 square feet in the same building that housed the public library and the regional social security office, and it was manned in the daytime by 3 officers. At the time, Salander had failed in her efforts to hack into the network for the research she was working on, but she had decided it might be worthwhile to spend a little time and energy acquiring access for future research. She had thought over the possibilities and then applied for a summer job at the library in Longvik. In a break from her cleaning duties, it took her about 10 minutes to get detailed blueprints of the whole building. She had keys to the building, but understandably not to the police offices. She had discovered, however, that without much difficulty she could climb through a bathroom window on the 3rd floor that was left open at night in the summer heat. The police station was patrolled by a freelance security firm, and the officer on duty made rounds only once a night. Ridiculous. It took her about 5 minutes to find the username and password underneath the police chief's desk blotter, and one night of experimenting to understand the structure of the network and identify what sort of access he had, and what access had been classified as beyond the realm of the local authorities. As a bonus, she also got the usernames and passwords of the 2 local police officers. One of them was 32-year-old Maria Ottosson, and in her computer, Salander found out that she had recently applied and been accepted for service as a detective in the fraud division of the Stockholm police. Salander got full administrator rights for Ottosson, who also had left her Dell PC laptop in an unlocked desk drawer. Brilliant. Salander booted up the machine and inserted her CD with the program Asphyxia 1.0, the very first version of her spyware. She downloaded the software in 2 locations, as an active, integrated part of Microsoft Internet Explorer, and as backup in Ottosson's address book. Salander figured that even if Ottosson bought a new computer, she would copy over her address book, and chances were that she would transfer it to the computer at the fraud division in Stockholm, where she reported for duty a few weeks later. Salander also placed software in the officer's desktop computers, making it possible for her to gather data from outside and, by simply stealing their identities, to make adjustments to the criminal register. However, she had to proceed with the utmost caution. The police security division had an automatic alarm if any local officer logged on to the network outside working hours, or if the number of modifications increased too dramatically. If she fished for information from investigations in which the local police would not normally be involved, it would trigger the alarm. Over the past year, she had worked together with her hacker associate Plague to take control of the police IT network. This proved to be fraught with such difficulty that eventually they gave up the project, but in the process they had accumulated almost 100 existing police identities that they could borrow at will. Plague had a breakthrough when he succeeded in hacking into the home computer of the head of the police data security division. He was a civil service economist with no in-depth IT knowledge, but with a wealth of information on his laptop. Salander and Plague thereafter had the opportunity, if not to hack into, at least to devastatingly disrupt the police intranet with viruses of various types, an activity in which neither of them had the slightest interest. They were hackers, not saboteurs. They wanted access to functioning networks, not to destroy them. Salander now checked her list and saw that none of the individuals whose identity she had stolen was working on the investigation into the 3 murders. That would have been too much to hope for. But she was able to get in without much trouble and read details of the nationwide alert, including updated APBs on herself. She discovered that she had been sighted and pursued in Uppsala, Norrköping, Göteborg, Malmö, Hässelholm, and Kalmar, and that a classified computer image giving a better idea of what she looked like had been circulated. One of Salander's few advantages in all the media attention was that not many photographs of her existed. Apart from a 4-year-old passport photograph, which was also used on her driver's license, and a police mugshot taken when she was 18, which did not look anything like her today, there were only pictures from old school yearbooks and photographs taken by a teacher on a field trip to the Nacka Nature Reserve when she was 12. The pictures from the field trip showed a blurry figure sitting a little apart from the others. The passport photograph showed her with staring eyes, her mouth compressed to a thin line, and her head leaning a bit forward. It fitted the image of a retarded, asocial killer, and the media published millions of copies of it. But she now looked so different that very few people would recognize her from it. She read with interest the profiles of the 3 murder victims. On Tuesday, the media began to tread water, and with the lack of any new or dramatic revelations in the hunt for Salander, interest focused on the victims. Dag Svensson, Mia Johansson, and Niels Björman were portrayed in a long article in one of the evening papers. Niels Björman came across as a respected and socially involved lawyer, who belonged to Greenpeace and had a commitment to young people. A column was devoted to his close friend and colleague Jan Håkansson, who had an office in the same building. Håkansson confirmed the image of Björman as a man who fought for the rights of the little people. A civil servant at the guardianship agency described him as genuinely committed to his ward. Salander smiled her first, lopsided smile of the day. Johansson, the female victim in the drama, elicited great interest in the media. She was described as a sweet and enormously intelligent young woman, with an already impressive record of achievement and a brilliant career ahead of her. Shocked friends, colleagues at the university, and a tutor had given comments, and the question they had all asked was, why? Pictures showed flowers and lighted candles outside the door of the apartment building in Enschede. By comparison, very little space was devoted to Svensson. He was described as a sharp, fearless reporter, but the main interest was in his partner. Salander noted with mild surprise that it took till Easter Sunday before anyone seemed to realize that Svensson had been working on a big report for Millennium magazine. And even then, there was no mention in the articles about what specifically he was working on. She never read the quote Blomqvist had sent to Aftonbladet. It was not until late Tuesday when it was mentioned on the TV news that she realized Blomqvist was purposely putting out misleading information. He claimed that Svensson had been involved in writing a report on computer security and illegal hacking. Salander frowned. She knew that was false, and wondered what game Millennium was playing. Then she understood the message and smiled her second lopsided smile of the day. She connected to the server in Holland and double-clicked on the Mick Blom / laptop icon. She found the folder Lisbeth Salander and the document To Sally prominently displayed in the middle of the desktop. She double-clicked and read it. Then she sat for a long time staring at Blomqvist's letter. She wrestled with contradictory feelings. Up until then it had been her against the rest of Sweden, which in its simplicity was quite an elegant and lucid equation. Now, suddenly, she had an ally, or at least a potential ally, who claimed to believe she was innocent. And, of course, it would be the only man in Sweden that she never wanted to see again under any circumstances. She sighed. Blomqvist was, as always, a naive do-gooder. Salander hadn't been innocent since the age of 10. There are no innocents. There are, however, different degrees of responsibility. Björman was dead because he had chosen not to play according to the rules she had stipulated. He had had every chance, but still he had hired some fucking alpha male to do her harm. That was not her responsibility. But Kalle Blomqvist's involvement should not be underrated. He could be useful. He was good at riddles, and he was unmatchably stubborn. She had found that out in Hedestad. When he sank his teeth into something, he simply would not let go. He really was naive. But he could move in places where she couldn't. He might be useful until she could get safely out of the country.
which was what she assumed she would soon be forced to do. Unfortunately, Blomqvist could not be controlled. He needed a reason of his own to act, and he needed a moral excuse as well. In other words, he was quite predictable. She thought for a while and then created a new document called To Mick Blom, and wrote a single word. Zala. That would give him something to think about. She was still sitting there thinking when she noticed that Blomqvist had booted up his computer. His reply came shortly after he read her message.
"Lisbeth, you damn troublesome person. Who the hell is Zala? Is he the link? Do you know who murdered Doug and Mia? If so, tell me so we can solve this mess and go to sleep. Mikhail."
Okay, time to hook him. She created another document and called it Kalle Blomqvist. She knew that would upset him. Then she wrote a brief message. "You're the journalist. Find out." As expected, he replied at once, with an appeal for her to listen to reason, and he tried to play on her feelings. She smiled and closed her connection to his hard drive. Now that she had started snooping around, she moved on and opened Armansky's hard drive. She read the report about herself that he had written the day after Easter. It was not clear to whom the report was addressed, but she assumed that the only reasonable explanation was that Armansky was working with the police to help bring her in. She spent a while going through Armansky's email, but found nothing of interest. Just as she was about to disconnect, she lit upon a message to the technical chief at Milton Security with instructions for the installation of a hidden surveillance camera in his office. Bingo! She looked at the date and saw that the message was sent about an hour after her social call in February. That meant she would have to adjust certain routines in the automatic surveillance system before she paid another visit to Armansky's office. Chapter 22. Tuesday, March 29th to Sunday, April 3rd. On Tuesday morning, Salander accessed the police criminal register and looked up Alexander Zalachenko. He was not listed, which was not surprising since, as far as she knew, he had never been convicted of a crime in Sweden and was not even in the national database. When she had accessed the criminal register, she used the identity of Superintendent Douglas Schuld of the Malmö police. She got a mild shock when her computer suddenly pinged and an icon in the menu toolbar started blinking to signal that someone was looking for her in the ICQ chat program. Her first impulse was to pull the plug and shut down. Then she thought about it. Schuld had not had the ICQ program on his machine. Very few older people did. Which meant that someone was looking for her. And there were not many alternatives to choose from. She clicked on ICQ and typed the words, "What do you want, Plague?"
"Wasp, you're hard to find. Don't you ever check your mail?"
"How'd you find me?"
"Schuld. I've got the same list. I assumed you'd be using one of the identities with the highest authorization."
"What do you want?"
"Who is this Zalachenko you did the search on?"
"MYOB.
Question mark.
"Mind your own business."
"What's happening?"
"F.O., Plague."
"I thought I had a social handicap, as you call it. If I believed the papers, I'd seem totally normal compared to you." An image of a fist with a single finger raised appeared. "Fuck you, too. Need help?"
Salander hesitated. First Blomqvist and now Plague. Was there no end to all the people coming to her rescue? The problem with Plague was that he was a 350-pound recluse who communicated almost exclusively via the internet and made Salander look like a miracle of social skills. When she didn't answer, Plague typed another line.
"Still there? Do you need help getting out of the country?"
"No."
"Why did you shoot them?"
"Piss off."
"Do you intend to shoot more people, and if so, do I have to worry? I'm probably the only one who can track you."
"Mind your own business and you don't have to worry."
"I'm not worried. Look for me on Hotmail if you need anything. Weapon, new passport."
"You're a sociopath."
"Compared to you, you mean?"
Lisbeth disconnected from ICQ and sat down on the sofa to think. 10 minutes later, she sent an email to Plague's Hotmail address.
"Prosecutor Richard Ekstrom, leader of the preliminary investigation, lives in Täby. He's married with 2 children and has a broadband connection to his house. I need access to his laptop or home computer. I need to read him in real time. Hostile takeover with mirrored hard drive.
She knew that Plague himself seldom left his apartment in Sundbyberg, so she hoped he had cultivated some pimply teenager to do the field work. There was no need to sign the message. She got an answer 15 minutes later.
How much are you paying?
10,000 to your account plus expenses and 5,000 to your assistant.
I'll be in touch.
On Thursday morning she had one email from Plague containing an FTP address.
Salander was amazed.
She had not expected a result for at least 2 weeks. Doing a hostile takeover, even with Plague's brilliant program and his specially designed hardware, was a laborious process that required slipping bits of information into a computer 1 kilobyte at a time until a simple piece of software had been created. How rapidly it could be done depended on how often Ekstrom used his computer, and then it should normally take another few days to transfer all the data to a mirrored hard drive. 48 hours was not merely exceptional, it was theoretically impossible. Salander was impressed. She pinged his ICQ.
How did you do that?
4 computers in his household. Can you imagine? They have no firewall. Security zero. All I had to do was plug in the cable and upload. My expenses are 6,000 kroner. Can you handle it?
Yep, plus a bonus for the quick work.
She thought for a moment and then transferred 30,000 kroner to Plague's account via the internet. She did not want to frighten him off with excessive amounts. Then she made herself comfortable on her Werksam IKEA chair and opened Ekstrom's laptop. Within an hour she had read all the reports that Inspector Bublansky had sent to Ekstrom. Salander suspected that, technically, reports like these were not allowed to leave police headquarters. It proved once again the theory that no security system is a match for a stupid employee. Through Ekstrom's computer she gleaned several important pieces of information. First, she discovered that Armansky had assigned 2 of his staff to join Bublansky's investigative team without remuneration, which in practice meant that Milton Security was sponsoring the police hunt for her. Their assignment was to assist in the arrest of Salander by all possible means.
Thanks a lot, Armansky. I'll remember that.
She frowned when she discovered which employees they were. Bowman she had taken for a straight arrow, and he had been perfectly decent in his behaviour towards her. Hedstrom was a corrupt nobody who had exploited his position at Milton Security to swindle one of the company's clients. Salander had a selective morality. She had nothing at all against swindling the company's clients herself, provided they deserved it, but if she had accepted a job with a confidentiality agreement in it, she would never have broken it. Salander soon discovered that the person who had leaked the information to the media was Ekstrom himself. This was evident from an email in which he answered follow-up questions about both Salander's psychiatric report and the connection between her and Miriam Wu. The third significant piece of information was the insight that Bublansky's team did not have a single lead as to where they should look for Salander. She read with interest the report on what measures had been taken and which addresses had been put under sporadic surveillance. It was a short list. Lundegarten, obviously, but also Blomqvist's address, Miriam's old address at St. Eriksplan, and Kvarnen, where they had been seen together.
Fuck. Why did I have to involve Mimi? What a mistake that was.
On Friday, Ekstrom's researchers had also found the link to Evil Fingers. She guessed that would mean more addresses being visited. She frowned. So the girls in the group would vanish from her circle of friends too, even though she had had no contact with them since her return to Sweden. The more she thought about all this, the more confused she became. Ekstrom was leaking all kinds of bullshit to the media. His objective was clear. He was building publicity and doing the groundwork for the day when he would issue a charge against her. But why hadn't he leaked the police report from 1991, which had led her to be locked up at St. Stephen's? Why keep that story hidden? She went into Ekstrom's computer again and pored over his documents. When she was finished, she lit a cigarette. She had not found a single reference to the events of 1991 on his computer. It was strange, but the only explanation was that he didn't know about the police report. For a moment she was at a loss. Then she glanced at her power book. This was precisely the kind of thing that Kalle fucking Blomqvist could sink his teeth into.
She rebooted her computer to access his hard drive and created the document MB2.
Prosecutor E is leaking information to the media. Ask him why he didn't leak the old police report.
That should be enough to get him going. She sat patiently and waited 2 hours for Blomqvist to get online. He read his email, and it took 15 minutes before he noticed her document, and another 5 minutes before he replied with the document, cryptic. He didn't bite. Instead, he insisted that he wanted to know who murdered his friends. That was an argument that Salander could understand. She softened a bit and answered with cryptic too.
What would you do if it was me?
Which was intended as a personal question. He replied with cryptic 3. It shook her.
Lisbeth, if it's true that you've really gone over the edge, then maybe you can ask Peter Teleborian to help you. But I don't believe you murdered Doug and Mia. I hope and pray that I'm right. Doug and Mia were going to publish their exposés of the sex trade. My theory is that could have been the reason for the murders, but I have nothing to go on. I don't know what went wrong between us, but you and I discussed friendship once. I said that friendship is built on 2 things, respect and trust. Even if you don't like me, you can still depend on me and trust me. I've never shared your secrets with anyone, not even what happened to Venestrom's billions. Trust me, I'm not your enemy. M.
Blomqvist's reference to Teleborian at first made her furious. Then she realized that he was not trying to start a fight. He had no idea who Teleborian was, and had probably only seen him on TV, where he came across as a responsible, internationally respected expert. But what really shook her was the reference to Venestrom's billions. She had no idea how he had wormed out that information. She was absolutely certain that she had made no mistakes, and that nobody in the world could know what she had done. She read the letter over several times. The reference to friendship made her uncomfortable. She didn't know how to respond to it. A short time later, she created Cryptic 4.
I'll think about it.
She disconnected and went to her window seat. Salander had exhausted her supply of Billy's pan pizza, as well as the last crumb of bread and rind of cheese. For the last 3 days, she had survived on a packet of instant oats that she had bought on impulse, with the vague idea that she ought to eat more nourishing food. She discovered that half a cup of oats with a few raisins and a cup of water turned into an edible portion of hot cereal after a minute in the microwave. It was not only the lack of food that got her on the move. She had someone to look after. Unfortunately, that was not something she could do while holed up in her apartment. She went to her wardrobe and took out the blonde wig and Irene Nesser's Norwegian passport. Fröken Nesser did exist in real life. She was similar in appearance to Salander, and she had lost her passport 3 years earlier. It came to be in Salander's hands thanks to plague, and she had used Nesser's identity when necessary for almost 18 months. Salander took the ring out of her eyebrow and put on makeup at the bathroom mirror. She dressed in dark jeans, a warm brown sweater with yellow trim, and walking boots with heels. She took out a mace canister from her small supply. She also found her taser, which she hadn't touched in a year, and plugged it in to charge. She put a change of clothes in a shoulder bag, and at 11 on Friday night, 9 days after the murders, Salander left her apartment in Mosebacke. She walked to McDonald's on Hornsgarten. It was less likely that any of her former colleagues from Milton Security would run into her there than at the one near Slussen or at Medborgerplatzen. She ate a Big Mac and drank a large Coke. Then she took the No. 4 bus across Vesterbron to St. Eriksplan. She walked to Odenplan and found herself outside Bjurman's apartment building on Upplandsgarten just after midnight. She did not expect the apartment to be under surveillance, but she saw a light in the window of an apartment on the same floor. So she walked on towards Vanadisplan. The light was off when she came back an hour later. She went up the stairs on tiptoe, without turning on the light in the stairwell. With the aid of a Stanley knife, she cut the police tape that sealed the apartment. She opened the door without a sound. She turned on the hall lamp, which she knew could not be seen from the outside, and switched on a pen torch to light her way to the bedroom. The Venetian blinds were closed. She played the beam of light over the blood-stained bed. She recalled that she had been very close to dying in that bed, and suddenly had a feeling of deep satisfaction that Bjurman was forever out of her life.
The reason for her visit to the crime scene was to get two pieces of information. First, she didn't understand the connection between Bjurman and Zala. She was convinced there had to be one, but she hadn't been able to find it from anything she found in Bjurman's computer. Second, was an inconsistency that kept gnawing at her. During her nighttime visit a few weeks earlier, she noticed that Bjurman had taken documentation about her out of the file box where he kept all his guardianship material. The pages that were missing were part of his brief from the agency, which summarized Salander's psychological state in the most concise terms. Bjurman no longer had any need of these pages, and it was possible that he had cleared out the file and thrown them away. On the other hand, lawyers never throw away documents relating to an unfinished case. And yet, these papers had once been in the file box relating to her, and she had not found them in his desk or anywhere near it. She saw that the police had removed the files that dealt with her case as well as some others. She spent more than 2 hours searching every inch of the apartment in case the police had missed anything, but eventually she came to the conclusion that they had not. In the kitchen she found a drawer which contained various keys, car keys as well as a general key to the building and a padlock key. She quietly went up to the attic floor, where she tried all the padlocks until she found Bjurman's storage unit. In it was some furniture, as well as a wardrobe full of old clothes, skis, a car battery, cardboard boxes of books, and some other junk. She discovered nothing of interest, so she went back downstairs and used the general key to get into the garage. She worked out which was his Mercedes, but a brief search turned up nothing of value there either. She did not bother to go to his office. She had been there only a few weeks earlier, around the time of her previous visit to his apartment, and she knew that for the past 2 years he had hardly used it. Salander returned to Bjurman's apartment and sat on his living room sofa to think. After a few minutes she got up and went back to the key drawer in the kitchen. She studied the keys, one by one. One set belonged to front door and deadbolt locks, but another key was rusty and old-fashioned. She frowned. Then she raised her eyes to a shelf above the kitchen counter where Bjurman had put about 20 seed packets, seeds for a herb garden. He has a summer cabin, or an allotment somewhere. That's what I missed. It took her 3 minutes to locate a receipt, 6 years old, in Bjurman's account book, showing that he had paid for work on his driveway. And it took another minute to find an insurance policy for a property near Stallarholmen, outside Mariefred. At 5 in the morning she stopped at the 24-hour 7-Eleven at the top of Hantvergargarten, up by Friedhelmsplan. She bought an armful of Billy's pan pizzas, some milk, bread, cheese, and other staples. She also bought a morning paper with a headline that fascinated her. Wanted woman fled country? This particular paper did not, for some reason, name her. She was referred to instead as the 26-year-old woman. The article stated that a source within the police claimed that she might have escaped abroad and could now be in Berlin. The police had apparently received a tip that she had been seen in Kreuzberg at an anarcho-feminist club, described as a hangout for young people associated with everything from terrorism to anti-globalization and Satanism. She took the number 4 bus back to Södermalm, where she got off at Rosenlundsgarten and walked home to Mösebacke. She made coffee and had a sandwich before she went to bed. She slept until late in the afternoon. When she woke, she took stock and decided that it was high time she changed the sheets. She spent the evening cleaning her apartment. She took out the trash and collected newspapers in 2 plastic bags and put them in a closet in the stairwell. She washed a load of underwear and T-shirts and then a load of jeans. She filled the dishwasher and turned it on. Then she vacuumed and mopped the floor. It was 9 p.m. and she was drenched with sweat. She turned on the faucet in the tub and poured in plenty of bubble bath. She lay back and closed her eyes and brooded. When she woke up, it was midnight, and the water was cold. She got out, dried off, and went back to bed. She fell asleep almost immediately. On Sunday morning, Salander was filled with rage when she booted up her power book and read all the stupid things that had been written about Miriam Wu. She felt miserable and guilty. Wu's only crime was that she was Salander's acquaintance? Friend? Lover? She didn't quite know which word would describe her relationship with Mimi, but she realized that whichever one she chose, it was probably over.
she would have to cross one more name off her already short list of acquaintances. After all the shit written in the press, she could not imagine that her friend would want to have anything to do with that psychotic Salander woman ever again. It made her furious. She committed to memory the name of Tony